Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Research funding and activity appears to be hitting the big time at the University of Lethbridge, and the man in charge of making it all come together is Dr. Dennis Fitzpatrick. And among the team of superstars locating at the University of Lethbridge are molecular biologists Igor and Olga Kovalchuk. After cutting their teeth on research into the effects of radiation from the Chernobyl accident, they've now set up shop in southern Alberta, and already they're making world-class discoveries that will change plant breeding and cancer treatment. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Though small in size, the University of Lethbridge is growing by leaps and bounds in its ability to attract funding for specialized research. And this is helping Alberta's southernmost research institution lay the foundation for some spectacular science that can compete on the global stage. Dr. Dennis Fitzpatrick is the Vice President of Research at the University of Lethbridge.
NSERC has developed a new program to build capacity within some of the small and medium-sized universities. And they've challenged us to put together a capacity-building grant to help us move to that next echelon. And so it was interesting because they made it available to 36 universities and 34 of us applied. And they gave out seven grants for $1.5 million to build capacity in specific areas. Now, the University of Lethbridge really chose to invest in areas where we had some ongoing expertise. We invested in the Behavioral Neuroscience Group. We invested in an Earth Imaging Group. We invested in our Molecular Biologists. We invested in our Environmental Group, and we invested in the Physics Group. And the way we invested it was not to support ongoing research. It was to allow them to build capacity to move to the next echelon. And I'll give you a good example of this. The neuroscientists here at Lethbridge are very, very successful. And what they want to do is they want to explore the repair of brain after stroke and those kinds of events. And they wanted to get into the imaging of brains so that they could follow the time course of repair and look at some of those mechanisms. And to do this, the neuroscientists had to expand their team and bring in physicists. And this grant from NSERC enables us to go out and recruit physicists to actually run and organize and plan and to ensure that what our physiologists see is correct. And that really extends their range into a whole new set of research topics. And that's what these capacity building grants are all about. We're looking at taking this capacity building grant and working with a local geomatics company, Iunctus Geomatics, that owns the rights to a constellation of data of satellites for optical imaging of the Earth called the SPOT satellites. And what we hope to gain from this is the development of a whole set of research tools to look at issues surrounding agriculture, issues surrounding farm plans, environmental farm plans, water. We think that besides academic research interests, that people like Ducks Unlimited and those people that are keenly involved in environmental research are going to be quite interested in this new research tool that we're going to use this money to build this kind of relationship. And in fact, what we did with this grant was we lined up what we thought were five areas prime for growth and development and are making these kinds of investments in all five of those areas.
Why is that so important to the University of Lethbridge?
Well, the bottom line is universities really have no money to invest in innovation, growth, and development. We're certainly not going to use student tuition money to do that. And what the seed money does, it allows us to invest in a promising area of research so that our research can go out and compete not just for the funds that are available in Alberta, but largely for the funds that are available through the National Granting Council's Natural Science and Engineering Research Council of Canada and Canadian Institute of Health Research. We've got the people here. If we give the people the tools to go forward, they will do really good things. This $1.5 million grant over a five-year period, I believe in time will result in an increase in research activity at the University of Lethbridge by more than $1.5 million each and every year.
How is that going to affect the people here?
Well, research is all about people, and I'll be brutally honest. If a few years ago, we managed to recruit Olga and Igor Kovalchuk, two outstanding plant molecular biologists. And they have been incredibly successful at the University of Lethbridge. Their research program has grown and their impact on the campus has grown. We're at the point where we have to develop a whole new set of tools for them to go on to the next stage of their career. So what we are doing with this grant is we're investing in the development of what we're going to call the Center for the Production of Value-Added Oils. And what really that is that we're organizing our plant molecular biologists to take on some large, nationally important projects. And we think that by organizing and seeding this initiative that we are going to see them become successful, that their research program is going to grow, their impact in Alberta and Canada is going to grow, and because they have the tools here in Alberta to do internationally competitive research, we're going to keep them here in Alberta.
You're focusing on certain areas with this capacity grant from NSERC. Are there still some gaps?
Well, I think the one gap that really exists is where the people science, the social science actually touches the hardcore science. I mean, right now we're investing a lot of money in environmental research, but there are other areas out there that we should be looking at. For example, environmental goods and services. One of the things that we have to be careful of is losing those valuable infrastructure pieces that contribute to the quality of life. Marshes are a valuable infrastructure piece that purify water and make life very, very livable. But we haven't done that. We know they're important, but we don't know how much they contribute to the economy. And I think those kinds of research pieces are necessary for us to go forward. Barry Warburtz and the Canada West Foundation have drawn our attention to the natural capital in Alberta, particularly the eastern slopes of the Rockies and its pristine beauty. Do we actually know what that really means to our economy? Do we actually know what that means to our quality of life? In southern Alberta and in Alberta, we want to see people working on the landscape. So we actually have to understand the interrelationship between people and the economy and the science that drives the economy. And these are things that we haven't done well, to relate the hard science and the social science focusing on quality of life issues.
Have you got a plan to approach that?
Working on it right now.
Thank you very much, Dennis.
It's a pleasure, Cheryl.
That was Dr. Dennis Fitzpatrick, Vice President of Research at the University of Lethbridge. After studying the effects of radiation in Chernobyl, Drs. Igor and Olga Kovalchuk emigrated from the Ukraine to Alberta. Here, they work side by side at the University of Lethbridge, applying their expertise in radiation to biological concerns. For Igor, that's working with plants in the field of biotechnology.
Well, I study how plants react to the environment, how they respond to abiotic stresses like radiation, UV, drought, and biotic stresses like bacteria and fungi. And I want to understand how plants can change to adapt to those stresses, and I want to know to use this knowledge to make plants better and stronger, and hopefully help our agricultural biotechnology.
Now, you've already managed to make a few discoveries in that area. What is the most recent?
Well, I guess the most recent is the fact that we found out that plants can generate special type of signals when they are stressed, and this signal can be transmitted over generations, and this signal apparently makes plants to have broader resistance to variety of factors.
How do you stress them?
We apply different stresses. Recent work was done with virus, so we worked with tobacco and tobacco mosaic virus, as well as we treated our tobacco with ultraviolet radiation. We treated just single leaves and checking what would be the response of the whole plants. And we found that whole plant responses, and moreover, the plant can bring this response over the generation. Now we are turning to our important crops, and we'll be working with wheat to establish a system.
So is that essentially that environmental stresses will actually change or mutate a plant?
Well, obviously, if you know the history of our agro-biotechnology, we were starting with very small plants producing very little of seeds, and by breeding and selecting them, our human influence the way how plants are evolved, which they have been evolving before that for millions of years, and it means that they do have their own mechanisms to do that. And what we are trying to do, which sort of trying to speed up the evolution and trying to create conditions that would allow plants to adapt to broader type of stresses.
You're doing a fair bit of work with radiation. Why is that?
Well, our interest in radiation came all the way down from Ukraine. I am a Ukrainian citizen. And we've been studying the influence of radiation stemming from Chernobyl for probably last 10 to 12 years. And, it's not only radiation what bothers us, but it's just a unique laboratory, unique field where you can study how the plant genome is shaped up by extreme stress factors. It would be similar as you would bring the plant from a well-irrigated area to a drought areas like here that we have in Lethbridge, and studying how plants would adapt in number of years. So there are parallels that can be drawn from those studies.
Does it make a difference what type of radiation?
Oh, yeah, it makes a huge difference. So our UV radiation probably is the weakest. Also, it's a mutagen, but the weakest one. X-ray radiation is stronger, and ionizing radiation is extremely powerful mutagen.
The work that you're doing with radiation and the genetic mutations or changes within the plants from environmental stresses, what application does that have in the biotechnology field?
Well, if we understand how the strong mutagens or powerful environmental factors reshape the plant genome, what kind of changes they create, and how is it transmitted to next generation, we can use this knowledge to understand how moderate stresses like drought, high temperature, or flood, or even insects are influence the genome, how the plant reshapes its DNA, and how it creates new types of genes and new type of varieties. So I guess it has a direct application in biotechnology.
Is this going to speed up the process?
Well, if you compare the way how we generate better varieties and transgenic way, we are introducing the DNA from different cultivars to different species. And this is, first of all, it's quite expensive. Second, it's not well percepted by public. And that is right, because we still don't understand how the generation of new varieties via transgenic approach would influence the plant. In opposite, the way we want to do things, we want to design special conditions of stress for plants, provide the stress for 2-3 generations, and creating the population, let's say, of seeds that would make plants with higher resistance. I don't think it will speed up the process. It will make it much cheaper, first, and second, it will make it publicly acceptable, because we don't mess around with plants. Plants do it themselves.
What are you working on now?
Well, we're working on a broad variety of factors. We try to understand how our different conditions are, not only environmental, but, for example, the amount of minerals present, how do they influence the ability of plant to sort of propagate to better progeny, let's say, how they change their genome more efficiently. And indeed, we found that some microelements composition are better than the others, so we're now writing a patent on that. And yeah, it seems to be promising. Additional direction of our research, we want to understand whether transgenic food is safe or not. So we are analyzing the safety of transgenic foods in several trials feeding mice and rats, and we want just to prove or disprove. So we are completely neutral on that. What are transgenic plants? Whether they are same and whether they are safe.
In the work that you've been doing here at the University of Lethbridge, what would you consider the most surprising discovery that you've come across?
Well, it's still the same story that surprisingly we found out that plants don't have very specific ways of responding to this or that stress. It seemed to be that they have a broad mechanism. No matter what kind of stress, it all goes down to the same fact that plants are able to reshape parts of the genome, again, no matter what stress is present. And this was quite surprising, knowing how many different pathways stress plants have.
So they're quite adaptable then to survive.
Oh yeah, so I guess are probably right after bacteria and viruses, plants follow them in terms how frequently and how fast they can change upon the influence of environment.
Thank you very much, Igor.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Igor Kovalchuk, a molecular biologist and an assistant professor in biological sciences at the University of Lethbridge. The other half of the Kovalchuk team at the University of Lethbridge is Dr. Olga Kovalchuk. Her recent research involves radiation treatment and gene repair in cancer tumors. And one of the unique aspects of her experiments included a glowing yellow gene marker from a very special mouse. Her discoveries made the cover of a prestigious scientific publication, the Molecular Cancer Research Journal.
The whole story is about the effects of radiation exposure on our DNA, let's put it this way, and we use the mouse model to study this. So the mouse model is referred as recombinant mice, or the yellow fluorescent protein recombination substrate mice in the scientific way. So the whole idea is to be able to visualize the DNA damage and the homologous recombination, which is the mechanism to repair that damage, in vivo, and to be able to quantify the recombinogenic effects of radiation, in this case, on the DNA. And this is what we did using this mouse. So the mouse model was originally developed by the group of Dr. Bevan Engelward in the Biological Engineering Division in MIT. So this is a greatest collaboration, I think, out of all we had.
And it's quite a special mouse, isn't it? Because it glows yellow.
Oh, well, not all of it glows yellow, not all of it. So what glows yellow in this mice are only the cells where this recombination event has occurred.
And what is recombination?
Recombination is the special pathway that is used to repair the strand breaks in the DNA. So when DNA is broken into two pieces, when there is a region of homology, which is almost identical, two sequences that are almost identical, they will be used to repair this DNA. And so this is a mechanism that the cells utilize.
So they recombine, and that's where the recombination comes from. So how were you using this? How did you use the yellow mouse?
So what we did, I'd rather call it recombo mouse, because there is a yellow mouse, which is a bit different story. It's completely yellow and just glows. So the recombo mouse, what we did, we decided to look for recombinogenic effect of radiation on those animals. So the animals were exposed to different regimes of radiation. Either they were given a dose in one set acutely, or this dose was spread over 27 days, 27 equal installments, but the dose in the end was the same. So we wanted to know, would the different regime lead to the same effect on recombination?
So what did you find then doing these two different regimes, looking at the acute and then over the 27 days?
What we found was absolutely stunning for us. We found that the acute exposure, single dose exposure, leads to increase of recombination in animals, and this is congruent with what people have seen before, versus the chronic exposure led to actually suppression or fall of recombination. It fell so strongly, it fell even below the control levels. So we decided to try to really go deeper and understand why. This is a repair mechanism which is used. How comes we downregulate it? And what we found that actually cells in response to chronic exposure to radiation shift the balance between repair systems, because recombination is not the only type of repair used to repair strand breaks. There are the other two main types: non-homologous end joining, where cells simply stick their DNA together and glue them, which is predominant mechanism, and there is the so-called base excision repair pathway, which also is involved. What we found that chronic exposure strongly upregulates the proteins involved in those two pathways, strongly upregulates. And it was found in the whole animal in vivo. You can also reproduce the same effect if you do it in vitro in the cells. If you just grow cells in plates, expose them gradually to chronic exposure of radiation, that's going to same effect was occurring there. So what we find, we think that cells just shift the balances between the repair systems they have in response to chronic exposure. And this may be their way to adapt to constant, in a way, or prolonged or repetitive exposure to radiation over 27 days, every day they're hit. And they maybe decide that we'd rather do this repair mechanism versus this, because maybe then we'll be doing better.
The research that you were doing then, what sort of insight does this give you into the mechanism of how these different carcinogenic things work within the body?
Changes on DNA level are the key to tumor development, genetic disorders, aging, whatnot. And this animal model, we have the ability to understand why this cell is fluorescing, because there was a recombination event. So we can now screen different components of different chemicals, different things for their recombinogenicity, and then put this data in parallel with the data of protein expression, of other chromatin structure, and have a complete picture. Look over generations, are those changes inherited? And have a complete picture of what's going on in actually on the level of DNA, really zoom in on the level of DNA with this awesome model. There was no model actually like that before.
So now that you've gotten this far with it, what's next?
Well, we are now trying to actually develop a rather big also collaborative effort to use those animals to understand the mechanisms of secondary tumorigenesis and transgenerational tumorigenesis, because radiation and chemotherapy are well known to induce secondary tumors. There is a higher risk of secondary tumorigenesis, mainly leukemias and lymphomas. And there are also some quite puzzling reports about the enhanced tumor predisposition in the siblings, in the children of parents who were exposed to different genotoxic drugs. The reports are rather conflicting, but anyways, there are still reports about the higher tumor predisposition there. So we want to put together a rather big project to look at the mechanisms of those events.
One of the other things that you've discovered in your research is that there's actually a difference between males and females. So there's a gender difference. What's that all about?
By absolute serendipity, I must admit, we found that different patterns of gene expression are induced by radiation exposure in males and females.
How significant was that?
It was very significant because we have seen the rather big amounts or large amounts of genes that changed their expression quite drastically. We found some important tumor suppressor genes that were downregulated, or the expression dropped in males versus the expression got up in females. And we followed up on several of them, and we confirmed that, yes, this is not an artifact. This is exactly what's happening. We looked into changes and also in different tissues and in different pathways, and they kind of all fold together, and the roots go into interference of hormonal signaling with stress signaling. Because we all know we have different hormonal levels. Females have estrogens, a lot of them, right? Progestins. Males have testosterone, androgens, right? So we hypothesize that possibly hormonal signaling is the key. Interference of hormonal signaling with stress signaling is the key. So we now know that estrogen is, as I say, partly to blame or to thank for the changes that are different in females, but it cannot be really singled out as the main cause and agent. The proper balance between estrogens and progestins is possibly important, but they do crisscross kind of with stress signaling. They bring their 5 cents worth, and thereafter, they actually possibly cause those sex differences in radiation responses. It's astonishing that they were not really looked close at before, because previously people were just pretty much looking into an average human being or an average person of an average weight and an average age. And yes, we do know that sex organs are kind of target organs. They better be protected. But overall, nobody really looked into other responses really different. But on the other hand, there are certain tumors that are known to be induced by radiation, like rhabdomyosarcoma, which has the sex ratio. It's more common in males than in females. And we looked into the muscle tissue, and we see different profile of gene expression in males and females.
If you look down the road, what significance does this have for people like you and me who are wondering, am I going to get cancer at some time in the future? What sort of treatment is going to be best? How does your research fit into that scenario?
Well, I think this all is well down the road in the long run. But clearly, and we cited it in one of our papers, according to National Cancer Institute in the U.S., actually 1/3 of people alive today are likely to get cancer, and half of them are likely to get some form of radiation therapy. So obviously, understanding the differences between males and females may in the long run lead to development of treatment protocols that may be a bit better for males or maybe a bit better for females.
Thank you very much, Olga.
You're most welcome.
That was Dr. Olga Kovalchuk, a molecular biologist and an assistant professor in biological sciences at the University of Lethbridge. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Ingenuity, Alberta Research Council, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, Science Alberta Foundation, Ducks Unlimited Canada, and the Alberta Conservation Association. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.